Good morning. Exodus chapter 23, verses 1 to 19. Do not spread false reports. Do not help a guilty person by being a malicious witness. Do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. When you give testimony in a lawsuit, do not pervert the justice by siding with the crowd, and do not show favoritism to a poor person in a lawsuit. If you come across your enemy's ox or donkey wandering off, be sure to return it. If you see the donkey of someone who hates you fallen down under its load, do not leave it there. Be sure you help them with it. Do not deny justice to your poor people in the lawsuits. Have nothing to do with a false charge, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the innocent. Do not oppress a foreigner. You yourselves know how it feels to be foreigners, because you were foreigners in Egypt. For 6 years you are to sow your fields and harvest the crops, but during the 7th year let the land lie unploughed and unused. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what is left. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days do your work, but on the 7th day do not work, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and so that the slave born in your household and the foreigner living among you may be refreshed. Be careful to do everything I have said to you. Do not invoke the names of other gods. Do not let them be heard on your lips. 3 times a year you are to celebrate a festival to me. Celebrate the festival of unleavened bread, for 7 days eat bread made without yeast, as I commanded you. Do this at the appointed time in the month of Aviv, for in that month you came out of Egypt. No one is to appear before me empty-handed. Celebrate the festival of harvest with the first fruits of the crops you sow in your field. Celebrate the festival of ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in your crops from the field. 3 times a year, all the men are to appear before the Sovereign Lord. Do not offer the blood of a sacrifice to me, along with anything containing yeast. The fat of my festival offerings must not be kept until morning. Bring the best of the first fruits of your soil to the house of the Lord your God, and do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk. Amen.
This morning we're looking at the next chunk of the book of Exodus. And we've been working our way from the start through narrative. We've been following the rescue of God's people from slavery in Egypt through God's prophet Moses. And we've seen it as God has taken them out of slavery into the wilderness and to Mount Sinai, where God has met with them. And he's met with them, and we read at the start of chapter 19 that God says, you yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. God has given his, God has rescued his people, and now he says, you are to be a kingdom of priests for me. I've chosen you to be priests. That is to represent something of who I am to the world around, and to allow the world around you to come to know me. That's kind of the function of a priest. And so then we had last week, we looked at the Ten Commandments, 10 laws, 10 rules that both say something about the character of God, but also what his people are to be like. And some people might come and say, well, what relevance do laws like this have today? What relevance do the Ten Commandments, or these laws that Moses then goes on to elaborate in today's passage, what relevance do they have today? We've got chapter 21, chapter 22, and chapter 23, the latter of which we had read to us. And we've got that objection. What relevance do laws given to an ancient people have for us today in 21st century Stockton? Actually, there's a, there's another objection that you might have, and it's not just that these laws are irrelevant, but that actually somehow they are wrong. Here is a quotation from a fictional US president, Josiah Bartlett, from about 20 years ago. And he is commenting on this exact part of the Old Testament, the law that God gives his people. And he says this: "I wanted to sell my youngest daughter into slavery, as sanctioned in Exodus 21, verse 7. She's a Georgetown sophomore, speaks fluent Italian, always cleared the table when it was her turn. What would a good price be for her? While thinking about that, can I ask another? My chief of staff insists on working on the Sabbath. Exodus 35, verse 2 clearly says he should be put to death. Am I morally obligated to kill him myself, or is it okay to call the police? Does the whole town really have to be together to stone my brother John for planting different crops side by side? Can I burn my mother in a small family gathering for wearing garments made from two different threads? Think about those questions, would you?" Worse than irrelevant, are not some of these laws morally wrong? That is what many people would say about this part of the Bible. Not just irrelevant, but wrong. And I hope as we go through this, we'll see that that is not the case. That actually these laws both show something of the wonderful character of God and the wonderful community that he has called his people to be. Remember the context. This is a rescued people called to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. They have been rescued to worship the Lord. And so when we look at Old Testament laws like chapters 21 to 23 of Exodus, we're asking the question, what can they show us about the character of God? About how God must be worshipped? But also, what does it show us about how his people are to be distinctive in reflecting God's character to the world? A couple more things before we look at some of the detail of these chapters. We have to remember the kind of laws here that we are talking about. Many of the laws in the Old Testament are, if you like, worked examples of the Ten Commandments, showing how the Ten Commandments are worked out in different situations. Now, we're not in the same situation as God's people in the book of Exodus. I think Matt mentioned last week that none of us are likely to own bulls or oxen. But just have a look down at chapter 21 and verses 28 and 29. Talking about your a bull that someone might own. Chapter 21, verse 28. "If a bull gores a man or woman to death, the bull is to be stoned to death and its meat must not be eaten. But the owner of the bull will not be held responsible. If, however, the bull has had the habit of goring, and the owner has been warned, but has not kept it penned up, and it kills a man or woman, the bull is to be stoned, and its owner is also to be put to death." This law is about negligence. It's not just about bulls. It's about someone who knew that there might have been danger, but did absolutely nothing about it, even though it was their responsibility. The owner's been warned about his bull, but doesn't keep him locked up, and that makes him responsible. A contemporary case would be something like drink driving. If I'm driving under the influence and I hit someone, I can't argue that I'm not really at fault. Because of diminished responsibility. You know, I was drunk, so therefore, I didn't really know what I was doing. It's not my fault. No. I am more responsible because I know the effects alcohol will have on my driving, and yet I still chose to get behind that wheel. I'm negligent. I'm more at fault. Now, I'm not going to get into, I'm afraid, the issue of the death penalty this morning. If that is an issue for you and you're thinking, what on earth is going on here, please do chat to me afterwards. But one more thing to say about the kind of laws we're talking about here. We've said that they're kind of occasional or worked examples in a particular context, but they're also, some of them are symbolic. That is, they're a picture of something about God that God's people are supposed to live out. So throughout Exodus so far, we've had this picture that in redeeming his people, God is almost like recreating the way things should be. So we've seen pictures tying us back to creation. If you remember the way that God's people were taken through the waters of the Red Sea, that is the waters of chaos receding, just like in the creation story, and a new people going through and emerging onto the land. There's just little pictures, not like explicit, but just little pictures of stuff to do with creation. God's giving us this picture of, in bringing his people out, it's like a recreation, a restarting of how things were meant to be. And so there are laws to do with the right ordering of things, pointing to the fact that God's world is a world of order, not chaos. So just as God separated the land and the sea in creation, the Israelites are not to eat animals that confuse the two. So land creatures with fish-like scales, like snakes, or sea creatures without snails, without scales. They're not to use two different types of cloth in the same garment, not just because they might shrink at different rates pulling the garment apart, but just to symbolize that kind of order. They were, if you like, to be walking pictures of the order that God intended for his creation. It's not that there was something inherently morally wrong about having a cotton polyester mix, but they were meant to be showing this picture of order to the people near them. Or in the end of this passage, chapter 23, verse 19, you may have noticed it as Chris read it, "Do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk." What's going on there? Why weren't they to do that? Well, the kid shouldn't be cooked in its mother's milk because what is intended to bring it life shouldn't cause its death. It's the kind of mixing of two different things. Something that caused life shouldn't cause its death. It's order. It's also the possibility that it was a pagan fertility practice that they were forbidden from doing, but we don't actually know exactly. But these are all different ways that God's people can testify, can show the world around them what he is like. And then finally, before we do a quick overview of these laws, let's notice just how they cover pretty much every part of life. So in these three chapters, God's people are to be radically different to those around them because God is radically different. And that will affect every aspect of life. They affect the pattern of the working week, how they treat their servants or employees, how they relate to their family, their friends, their neighbors. There are laws of property. There are laws of personal relationships. There are laws of provision for the poor. And while we are not ancient Israel, and so we don't follow the letter of each law today, how much more should our community, the Church of Christ, be distinctive in every part of our lives compared to the world around us? So with those kind of things in mind, let's do a rapid overview of these chapters, starting in chapter 21. And as we go through, some of the things I will have more to say about, some I will move on quite quickly. And those in home groups will have a chance to perhaps dig into a bit more of the detail this week. But there's just too much to go into in the same depth. But remember, as we're going through, we're seeing what do these laws say about what God is like and how his people are to be distinctive. So first, we have chapter 21, verses 1 to 11. And the summary here, if you like, is God providing protections for workers. So, chapter 21, verse 2, "If you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year he shall go free without paying anything." Some translations will translate this Hebrew slave, Hebrew servant. The thing about this is that it was something that was voluntary in ancient Israel. People would, if you like, tie themselves to a master to be their servant in order to pay off a debt or in order to effectively to find work with someone because they were unable to provide for themselves. So often to do with debts and poverty. And for male servants in verses 2 through to 6, God puts in place two things. That he puts in place first limits on service. So even if you were to effectively sell yourself to an employer, there was a limit. It wasn't for life. There was a way out, which was very different to the kind of relationships with servants that the world around had. But there was also an option of lifelong service. Verse 5, if the servant declares, I love my master, my wife and my children, and I do not want to go free, then his master must take him before the judges. He shall take him to the door or the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl. Then he will be his servant for life. Notice something striking at the start of that verse. If the servant declares, I love my master. Masters in Israel were supposed to treat their servants in such a way that the servants would love them. Love them enough to commit to them for life. That is an incredible type of provision for a lowly employee. Those here with bosses, do you love your boss? It's kind of a silly question. Bosses in Israel were supposed to treat their workers in such a way that this had to be provided for in the law. Somebody saying, I love my master, I want to commit to them. Then verse 7 and onwards, we have stuff about female servants, and immediately we're getting a little bit itchy because, verse 7, if a man sells his daughter as a servant, she is not to go free as male servants do. What's going on? Is this treating women worse? No. In fact, it is exactly the opposite. She is not to go free as male servants do. If she does not please the master who has selected her, he must let her be redeemed. That is, she can leave. She can go back to the family who had sold her. He has no right to sell her to foreigners. He's broken faith with her. If he selects her for his son... Oh, wait, okay. So what we're actually talking about here is a poor family who have a daughter who sends their daughter to a wealthier family on the basis that the son of the family, the heir, might marry their daughter. And the expectation is that he would. This is, if you like, a marriage agreement rather than a situation of slavery. This is someone going to serve in a household and then being welcomed into the family as a daughter. Far from treating women worse than men, there is protection. She can leave immediately if the master's not going to marry her or let her marry his daughter. And if she stays, then she is adopted as a daughter of the family. She is provided for life. In a society where actually, you know, having the right, having enough food, being protected, wasn't an assumption, you know, wasn't something you could take for granted, particularly as a woman. Here is a situation where, verse 10, even if the master marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and marital rights. If he does not provide her with these three things, she is to go free. In other words, the master's responsibility is to provide for this woman for life. It is to protect her. And these kind of laws point to the kind of master we have in God. One we can serve with love because of the incredible love he has shown us. But it's also a way for Christians to be distinctive. Now, we don't have the same kind of legal or economic structures that we're talking about here, but there are ways for us to be distinctive in this way. A number of years ago, I worked for a large firm of accountants, and there was one of the partners who was just different to the others. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. Was it the way she treated her staff? Was it her attitude to money? I'm not sure what it was, but when I discovered that she was a Christian, it suddenly made sense. There was a distinctiveness to her behaviour at work, particularly towards those who worked for her, that marked her out as different. Maybe you're in a situation where you are responsible for staff. How can you care for them in such a way that they would willingly keep working for you because of how you do it differently? But maybe you're in the opposite situation. Perhaps that's more likely you're in a situation where you're with a boss who is a nightmare to work for, or a job that is insecure, where you're not sure you're going to get enough. Well, know this, God cares about your situation. For his people back then, he put in laws that would protect those struggling in poverty, protect workers. The fact that so often our society doesn't reflect these values is something to mourn and to pray about. And it's a way the church should be distinctive in showing love and care to each other where we are in those sorts of situations. So if work is a struggle, if your boss is hard, that is something that Christian brothers and sisters here should be able to support you and help you and pray for you in. It is not the way it should be. Moving on. Personal injuries is the title of our next section. And the summary here, verse 12, right the way through to the end of chapter 21, is not revenge, but restraint and restitution. So this section covers everything from the distinction between murder, manslaughter, aggravated assault, through to accidental death, the payment of compensation. Let no one accuse the Old Testament law of not being relevant. But here, the basic theme that runs through is the idea of preventing personal revenge. I visited a school on a council estate in Oxford when I lived and worked there. And I was chatting to a couple of lads there. And they were saying, oh, you know, what do you do if someone hits your, you know, hits your brother? Well, you know, you go and hit them back. That's just what you do. You kind of look out for your own. You take revenge effectively. They were saying, you know, someone hits your brother, you up the stakes. You make sure that it doesn't happen again. Well, here, the basic theme is to prevent personal revenge. It is something the community has to decide on what the right punishment is. There's appropriate restraint. There's restitution where there's been harm. Now, again, we might be shocked about the death penalty here. And again, come talk to me if that's an issue for you. But basically, the law is showing us the incredibly high value placed on the protection of life. Other societies of the day, powerful men could kill with impunity. Don't like what your slave's doing? Torture them, kill them. Not a problem. No one stops you. God's people, no. Murder is punishable by death. Powerful people cannot get away with it. Even the owners of dangerous animals are punished for their negligence, as we've already seen, and restitution paid. And much of this passage is summed up in verse 24. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Rather than a requirement for a level of punishment fitting to the crime, this is a restraint on revenge. You can't go beyond what is fair, God says. You may have heard that in some countries, a thief can have their hand cut off to stop them from stealing again. Not here. These laws are in place exactly to prevent that kind of thing from happening. And in living this way, God's people are to show perfect justice. Because the Lord God always does exactly what is right, so too his people. God will only ever give someone what their sins deserve. God's anger is never unreasonable. I'm guilty as a parent of losing my temper and being unfair as I punish my girls for some small thing they've done wrong. Sometimes I have to back down and apologize. Never with God. He is always fair, he is always just, and so are his people to be. Chapter 22. Summary here would be just making things right. Verse 5. If anyone grazes their livestock in a field or vineyard and lets them stray, and they graze in someone else's field, the offender must make restitution from the best of their vineyard. Verse 6, if a fire breaks out and spreads into thorn bushes so that it burns sheaves of corn, the one who started the fire must make restitution. Quite basic laws, there's much more in there, but consider the kind of community that these laws were meant to form. A community where people took responsibility for all their actions, even their accidents. Verse 16 and onwards. The title in the Bible here is social responsibility, but here it's basically care for the weakest. So verse 16, if a man seduces a virgin who has not pledged to be married and sleeps with her, he must pay the bride price, and she shall be his wife. This isn't talking about a situation of rape. It is talking about two people sleeping together before they get married, both consenting. And there is a protection for the woman in this situation. A woman who socially could have been left a complete pariah, unable to get married, looked down on. The man is required to pay the bride price, that is, to provide for her, to marry her, to make sure that she, in that society, is okay. And remember, this was a consensual relationship. This is saying, you should get married. And if her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, then still the money's got to be there to provide for her for life. Verse 21, do not ill-treat or oppress a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt. Treat foreigners well because of how you were treated. Foreigners who would have been in the most precarious financial situation in Israel, look after them. Care for the weakest. Verse 22, do not take advantage of the widow or the fatherless. Protect them. Protect the widows and their children. Again, the vulnerable in society. Verse 25, if you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, don't treat it like a business deal. Charge no interest. Don't make money off the poor, God says. Care for them. The 19th century philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche thought this was the worst aspect of the Christian faith. Christians care for the weak, the poor, the needy, the foreigner without friends or family. Nietzsche said, no. We want to rise above that slave morality, he called it, and seek power. That's what we should do. God's people are to be different from the way the world operates. We saw this before Christmas in the book of Ruth. The way Boaz cares and protects for Ruth and Naomi is a brilliant example of the kinds of things this passage shows us about what God's people are to be like. It points to the care of our loving Father. Psalm 113, verse 7 says this, God raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes. And as our society loses more and more of the Christian influence that has been there throughout the years, as a church, we have an opportunity to be the distinctive people that it's called for here. This passage gives us a manifesto to care for single moms, asylum seekers, orphans, the bereaved, those in debt, those in poverty. Because God cares deeply, so should we. Chapter 23. chapter 23. And the first 9 verses talk about justice and the law courts. And the summary here is no favoritism. Verse 1, don't lie to protect the guilty. In fact, more than that, don't even gossip in an unhelpful way, spreading rumours that could lead to justice not being done. Verse 2, don't just go with the flow. Don't stand with the crowd. Stand for what is right. Don't show favouritism. Verse 3, not to the poor. But verse 4, not even against your enemy. Verse 6, not against the poor either. No favoritism of any kind. Don't condemn the innocent. Don't acquit the guilty. Verse 7, don't accept bribes. Verse 8, and just in case we hadn't got it from earlier, verse 9, don't oppress a foreigner. That seems to be quite important to God. Caring for the foreigner matters. And so does justice. There are those here with us Sunday after Sunday who have faced horrific injustice. We know it is wrong, and this is one of the passages that shows us why. God is a God of justice. One day he will right every wrong. And God's people are to point to his perfect justice by being just themselves. I don't think anyone here is a lawyer or a judge, but we can all be honest. We can all treat all people with respect, even those we dislike, even those we might think of as enemies, those who oppose us, those who disagree with us. There's been much in the press this week about the Church of England and their response to gay marriage. There's also been a lot about the disagreement between the Scottish Parliament and the UK government over transgender rights. It's tempting, isn't it, to those on social media to jump into criticism, to personal attack. But we must not hate those on the other side of whatever kind of argument it is. We must not be unfair to them. We must not insult them. We must not applaud those who insult them. We must be careful, chapter 22, verse 28 says, to honour our leaders even when we profoundly disagree with them. God is a God of justice. He will ultimately bring what is right. But for us, we are called to honour our leaders, to fight for justice ourselves, but not to do that in a way that oppresses or dishonours even those who oppose us. Verses 10 to 13. And here the summary is that Sabbath rest is made for us. We don't have time, again, to get into the debate over what the Sabbath means for Christians exactly, but here we see something of who the Sabbath is for. As Jesus tells us in the Gospels, the Sabbath was made for us, not us for the Sabbath. We're to benefit from rest, but particularly in this passage, verse 11, it is the poor. Or verse 12, the slave, the foreigner, who are to benefit from the Sabbath rest. So perhaps think about this. How do our patterns of consumption or shopping, whether that's the use of supermarkets, internet retailers, or the kinds of clothes and who made them and how much we pay for them, have an impact on the rest that was guaranteed in God's law for his people? Who are the people in most need of a rest? Think about low-paid workers making shoes and clothes overseas, or zero-hours contract workers in warehouses, or the serving staff at restaurants, or the till workers at supermarkets. How do our choices affect them? The Sabbath was made to bring rest to people, particularly to the poor, the foreigner, the slave in this passage. And then the final section, the 3 annual festivals or the pilgrim feasts where God's people were to gather to celebrate God's provision for them. The first We're told about the festival of unleavened bread was to celebrate. It was directly after the Passover that celebrated the people's rescue from Egypt. Then you have the festival of harvest, verse 17, sometimes called the festival of first fruits or the feast of weeks in other parts of the Bible. And then the festival of ingathering, or sometimes known as booths or tabernacles. Each of those is expanded in other parts of Scripture, but in general, they are celebrating God's provision of salvation as a nation. Now, we don't gather every Christian together in Jerusalem three times a year, but we do gather each Sunday to celebrate God's rescue, his salvation, his blessing for his people, and we do that particularly in the Lord's Supper. And these festivals, and the Passover particularly, are like a forerunner of the Lord's Supper celebration for us. So just food for thought, perhaps something of the celebration and joy of these festivals might need to be recaptured as we celebrate on Sundays. But let me draw things together. We've covered a lot. If you're not a Christian here this morning, I hope that the picture I've painted of this society shows that far from being irrelevant or immoral, these laws do point to a generous and kind God and the welcoming and loving community that he wants for this world. Just imagine if we all lived like this, welcoming the stranger, caring for the weak, pursuing justice. Isn't this the world we all want? God's standards, God's laws would actually give us the kind of world that everyone, if they're honest, would want to be a part of. And the rest of the Bible tells us that all of these standards are summed up in the person of Jesus Christ. The Bible tells us that Jesus followed God's laws perfectly. He lived this life of justice, of care for the weak, of welcome for the stranger. Jesus is the standard that we all want. But of course, as we see this picture being painted, we see just how far we are from living up to it. Because this isn't the world we live in. More than that, so often the church falls far short of being the kind of community that reflects the kindness of God. But here's the thing, this passage points beyond itself to the good news of a God who is always more good and more kind than we can imagine. In chapter 21, verse 7 and onwards, we have the picture of a poor servant girl being adopted into the family as she marries the son, the heir. And in Jesus Christ, the one who trusts in him is adopted into the family of God. The Bible describes those who trust Jesus, his church, as his bride, welcomed into the family with the full rights of the heir. And it's ultimately Jesus's goodness and holiness we see pointed to in these laws. Jesus is the standard we all want, but Jesus is also the saviour that we all need. He is the standard we all want, but he is the saviour we all need. As Christians, we are called to follow the law of Christ, to be like him in every respect. But where we fail, Jesus' own life and obedience covers us. And it is in knowing that perfect forgiveness that frees us to live his way.